10 years ago, a magnitude 7 earthquake struck Haiti, causing apocalyptic damage in the capital of Port-au-Prince and surrounding cities. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
The reports and images that we've seen, collapsed hospitals, crumbled homes, and men and women carrying their injured neighbors through the streets, are truly heart-wrenching.
The quake struck right before sundown. It was a terrifying night. It destroyed communities, and it took the lives of as many as 200,000 people. A decade later, the country has not fully recovered. Today's program, we're devoting the entire hour to looking back on the 10-year anniversary of the earthquake. Where were you on that fateful day? Share your story with us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. All of that today on the show. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been 10 years since Haiti's devastating earthquake. It was close to 5 o'clock on January of 2010 in the late afternoon when a magnitude 7 earthquake struck roughly 25 kilometers west of Port-au-Prince. The trauma still exists within Haitians in Haiti and here in the U.S. Today's program, we're devoting the entire hour to looking back on that fateful day and how people are trying to move on from it 10 years later. We're joined in studio by WLRN reporter Nadege Green, WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett. We have a special guest this segment, Professor Elanan Bar-On. He's the director of the Sheba Medical Center in Israel, and he was on the ground in Haiti days after the earthquake struck. And joining us via Skype from Haiti is Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. Now, we've been hearing a lot of stories from people like this one from Edward, who was a communication student when the earthquake struck Haiti. He was looking for his fiancée under the rubble.
Now I lose all hope to see my fiancée again.
Edward says he felt especially hopeless as he scanned corpses crushed in Saint-Gerard's wreckage.
Horrible. Body on body, literally broken. Arms, feet, it's indescribable. So I go under the concrete. Jocelyn, where are you? And when I'm calling her for maybe 1 hour, I hear some voice.
It was Jocelyn, her legs badly injured, but alive.
And that again is from this week's Latin America report by Tim Padgett. How did the earthquake impact your life? You could find us on social media at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@WLRN.org. Let me turn now to my panel. And I want to start with Jacqueline Charles, who, again, is in Haiti. And Jacqueline, I'm wondering if there are any remnants of the earthquake, anything that reminds you of the earthquake, or if all of that has been erased by now.
Well, I mean, the rubble is gone, but when you go by the National Palace, for instance, it's gone. It's not there. So you know that something happened. When you go by the Port-au-Prince Cathedral, the ruins are still there. It hasn't been rebuilt. And while you don't see the tent cities in plain sight anymore, there are still tent cities. You just have to go off the main roads and in the interiors and you see them. So we are constantly reminded of this quake, but often people forget that as well. So that's the challenge, that the rebuilding has been slow. Not a lot of it has been done. But at the same time, people sometimes forget that it was just 10 years ago that this capital was devastated.
Remind us, for you, where were you when you heard about the quake and imagine that you started reporting on it right away, right?
Well, yes, I actually was at One Herald Plaza and I was on the phone with someone in Haiti. I was actually planning a trip to come to Haiti the following weekend. And I was with him between being on the phone and texting, and he was at the Montana Hotel. And I remember after I got here, I spent days trying to figure out whether or not he was still alive or not. I was also working on a story that day because President René Préval, who was president at the time, had gotten himself in trouble with the IMF because of a loan that he had taken out with Venezuela to build a new airport in the northern part of the country. And President Bill Clinton was on his way to D.C. along with the Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Marc Bellerive and with Leslie Voltaire, who was Haiti's rep to the UN. They were all going to go to meet with officials of the IMF to basically plead Haiti's case. And that's when a colleague of mine, Nancy San Martin, came over and says, AP just moved a bulletin. Haiti was hit by an earthquake. And I was here in Haiti before 12 o'clock the next day.
Tim, you were working for Time Magazine, living here in South Florida, for Time Magazine.
Right. I was here in Miami. Mm-hmm.
And you hear about the earthquake. And I mean, first of all, how did you hear about it?
I originally was informed by a reporter here, one of my reporters who covers Haiti quite extensively, and I immediately tried to call people in Haiti. That was nearly impossible until almost miraculously I got in touch with a friend that I knew in Pétionville, a suburb of Port-au-Prince, a few hours after the earthquake hit. And by that time, the horrors of the disaster were raging in full form. And she was telling me about all of the awful voices she was hearing inside the rubble of collapsed houses and buildings in her neighborhood. And that's when I got a pretty full appreciation of just how horrific this was.
And you spent quite a bit of time in the months following back and forth to Haiti.
Yeah.
What's the most memorable, you know, painful probably, I'm sure, but most memorable experience for you in reporting that story?
I have to tell you, that probably the moment that I came into Port-au-Prince, I came in on a U.S. Navy helicopter. I was able to get in with some of the Navy personnel going in to deliver relief supplies. And we came in over one of the slums in Port-au-Prince known as Cité Soleil. And I was struck most because one of the things we have to remember about this earthquake is that before the earthquake, things were really looking up in Haiti. The economy was improving. The political situation was stable. People were feeling really optimistic, and they had more money. And what did they do with that money? A lot of them, even in slums like Cité Soleil, they built new masonry block homes. All of those homes I saw as we came over Cité Soleil were demolished. And the only homes standing in Cité Soleil were the ramshackle wooden shacks that people had been trying to move out of. So that really put into full relief for me just how awful this was, not just in terms of the physical devastation, but the psychological devastation for a country that was feeling optimistic and now had that suddenly just wiped out.
Nadege, you were a young reporter at the time. How did you hear about it?
I'm still a young reporter.
You're still a young reporter, of course. you had a lot of extended family in Haiti.
All of my family is in Haiti outside of my immediate family. So all my aunts, uncles, cousins, everyone lives in Haiti. So yeah, at the time I was covering a meeting for the Miami Herald. Jackie and I were colleagues, and I think I ended up covering much of, you know, the post-earthquake reporting from the diaspora side, like what it looked like here in Miami. But immediately after the earthquake, I just remember the search, this trying to find your loved ones, but being powerless to do so, right? Because you can get on a plane and go to Haiti in that moment. And it was pretty much a blackout. There was a wireless blackout. You couldn't call into Port-au-Prince. It was really hard, you know, to find out what was going on because you weren't on the ground. And it was hard to get people on the ground to tell you what was going on. I mean, we have family, you know, in Guamon and other parts of Haiti that were unaffected by the earthquake. But if you were in Port-au-Prince, like, we couldn't get news. And most of the young people in our family live in Port-au-Prince because they're in school there. And so it was like for all of the young people, all of my cousins, we just couldn't get any news. And that was, I remember feeling just totally powerless, and you're just waiting on a call
because
text.
Part of it for you is, I mean, you're a reporter, you're doing your job, but you have your family there and you're trying to connect to figure out what's going on.
Absolutely. I think if you are of Haitian descent, I know this, Jackie, same thing, you know, you're working, you know, you have to cover this, but you're also living it at the same time in a way that maybe some of our colleagues didn't have. I know many of our colleagues didn't have that experience.
I want to turn over to Professor Elanan Baran, joining us here again, Director for Disaster Medicine and Humanitarian Response at the Sheba Medical Center in Israel. I wanted to make sure I get the title correct. My apologies earlier. You go to crisis centers to help after disasters. How quickly after the earthquake were you in Haiti?
Well, I was actually in, when I was in Israel, the way I heard about it, I was scheduled to go to South India to give an orthopedic course. I'd been preparing this. This was a bunch of people from Harvard. And I get a phone call, and they said there's been an earthquake in Haiti. This is a phone call from the Israel Defense Force Medical Corps, where I'm a reservist. And they said, and we're going to Haiti. And it took me about 3 seconds to cancel India. And a few hours later, I was on the plane. We landed in Port-au-Prince on day 3 following the earthquake. And this was, you know, 10,000 kilometers away after mobilizing a full-scale field hospital. One of the first things I remember is we met our ambassador, and he just took me to an enclave the UN set up right near the airport. It was a tented thing, hundreds of people lying there, injured, getting very minimal treatment. And for each one in there, there's another 200 people waiting outside to get in. We set up the hospital within 12 hours from landing, and at 89 hours from the earthquake, after coming from Israel and setting up the hospital, we opened our gates and started treating patients.
Had you ever seen anything like this in your experience?
Yes. I had been to an earthquake in Turkey before, and in Gujarat, India, 9 years before that. So I had seen earthquakes, but the magnitude, I mean, Haiti is in a class of its own, as far as what we saw there, as far as the way the population was affected. Unfortunately, because of very, very poor baseline, both of medical treatment and of building infrastructure, add to that the fact that the epicenter was only 25 kilometers from the center of Port-au-Prince and very shallow at 10 kilometers, so the damage was devastating. And whoever was there, what hits you first is the smell.
What was the biggest frustration for you when you were there setting up? What was the biggest frustration?
Look, when you deal with these things, you'll always be at a complete imbalance between the needs and your ability to fulfill these needs. So you turn off your frustrations very quickly. You don't deal with your frustrations. You deal with what we call in disaster management doing the best for the most. You obviously change your way, the way you treat patients, the way you triage patients. Disaster medicine is a profession. It's a state of mind. You change your diskette. You cannot do the medicine you do at home in a tent in Haiti, both because of the magnitude and because of the resources you have. You will not be in a sterile environment. So as an orthopedic surgeon, it's a completely different way of treating patients.
It almost sounds like a war zone type
it
of situation.
Let me tell you, being in Israel, I've been in wars. And I must say, it was a war zone. Besides the fact that we never felt any personal insecurity,
yes.
But besides that, it was a full war zone.
We are spending this hour today talking about the 10-year anniversary of the Haiti earthquake. I have a panel of reporters and experts here sharing their stories, and we're getting stories from you as well. You can message us on social media at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@wlrn.org. We heard from Will L. He emailed us. I flew from Fort Lauderdale Airport and arrived in Port-au-Prince, Haiti on Monday the 11th. My grandmother was to be buried that week. The next day, my family and I found ourselves at the epicenter of the worst natural disaster in the country's history, a day we will never forget. Again, you can share your story with us. Jacqueline, let me come back to you. What was, for you in your reporting, what did you see as the biggest frustration for people in Haiti in the days and weeks after the earthquake?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I had an interesting perspective because when I arrived in Haiti, I walked directly into the entire Haitian government, including the president. They were all on the tarmac, and they had set up shop at the police detective bureau near the airport. Most of the foreign journalists that flew into Haiti, they basically parked themselves at the international airport. And so what you saw were two different press conferences being held. I mean, people often criticized the President Rene Préval a lot during those days, but he was the most communicative. He spoke a lot, you know, we knew a lot what was going on. And it was just interesting watching the international representative, the ambassadors and the donors, they were all sort of jockeying to be the one, the person. And I remember being invited into a meeting by President Preval with U.S. officials where he was asking for tents, and they were not interested in providing tents. And they were basically talking about, well, in other disasters, we've done this, and here's what we've done, and we need to get the economy moving, and we need to let people start to rebuild. But President Preval, who was not a guy who talked a lot, understood that the minute you allow Haitians to put down bricks and mortar, you're going to have a problem, and that problem is going to be tent cities all over this place. And so the tents never came, but the tent cities did. So back to your question, I think the biggest frustration for Haitians in those days was just sort of trying to figure out what was going to come next, where they were going to live. They were sleeping, you know, out in the streets. They were exposed to the elements. But at least in that first month, I can tell you that there was this unprecedented unity among Haitians, maybe that we haven't seen since 1804, because everybody was in it. Whether you were rich, poor, middle class, everybody was going through the same thing.
You know, Nadej, I'm always fascinated by the stories of the relationships between Haitians in Haiti and the diaspora. What was it like after the earthquake? She's talking about everybody was in it, but what was it like here?
Same thing. I think, you know, that theme of unity was very real. People, I actually ended up staking out and hanging out at a lot of the money transfer places after, in the weeks after the earthquake. So Western Union, Com Money Transfer. And, you know, I would just be standing out there as folks are coming together to try to send whatever money they can or any kind of provisions home. And inside, it became sort of like this therapeutic setting where you had Haitians talking about who they lost and what they lost, you know, so like everyone came together, or whether, you know, it was Notre Dame d'Haïti Catholic Church became home base, you know, in Miami, where people were coming in and bringing in all kinds of supplies and water and pallets of goods. You know, I saw older Haitian women who didn't have a lot of money, but if they brought in 3 bottles of water, they brought something, you know. So, and same thing up in Broward and Palm Beach County, you had, you know, these hubs that were set up. And in a lot of cases, these hubs became places for people to also grieve their losses together, because this was a sense of communal loss, right? Like it really did touch everyone in some kind of way.
You know what, coming over here, I want to get to the professor again, Baron. I wanted to ask you again about some of the things that you saw. One of the other challenges is also the fact that a lot of people were injured, and one of the big problems, one of the big challenges was amputations, the issue of amputations for people.
Right. Well, first of all, we in our hospital, we tried to amputate, to avoid amputations. Number one, because there are ways to avoid amputations even in an earthquake, and there are ways to preserve limbs. And number two, because realizing the significance of being an amputee in Haiti, which is very different than being an amputee in a place where there are very, very well-developed rehabilitation centers. So on the way back, we stayed for about 2 weeks. On the plane back, I didn't sleep because I said this must be followed up by a rehabilitation effort. The next day, I was with people in Sheba Medical Center from the rehabilitation department. And a week later, we were back in Haiti, and we set up in HUEH, in the central hospital, we set up a rehabilitation center and prosthesis center, which operated for about the year after the earthquake. I went back to Haiti several times that year, and I'd like to tell you about one patient.
Yes.
Mika was a 23-year-old girl. She was the last patient to be to reach our hospital directly from the rubble. She was under a beam for a week with a friend in the room. They had one apple. They survived. She was extricated from the rubble after a week and brought to our hospital. We fought for her leg for 2 or 3 days, but we had to amputate it because she would otherwise have died. In one of my subsequent trips to Haiti, I went out to Albert Schweitzer Hospital in the mountains, where they had a rehabilitation center, and I had the privilege of holding her hand when she made her first steps on the prosthesis. But that's not the end. I just came back from Haiti yesterday. We gave a course on treatment of burns, nothing to do with the earthquake. I located Mika, I met her, and it was a very, very emotional meeting for both of us, as you can imagine.
That is a fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know that we are short on time and you have to get going, but thank you for sharing that with us. That does sound like a beautiful story. Again, talking with Professor Elanan Bar-An. He's the Director for Disaster Medicine and Humanitarian Response at the Sheba Medical Center in Israel. And again, spending today's program looking at the 10-year anniversary of the Haiti earthquake. And we, again, have been collecting a lot of stories from people. We heard from Maika and Maritza Molit, the sisters. They are the author of the book, Dear Haiti, Love Elaine. And they shared this amazing story with us.
Hi, this is Maika Molit and Maritza Molit. So, Maika, tell me, where were you when you first heard about the earthquake?
I was an undergraduate student at Florida State University when I first learned about the earthquake in Haiti 10 years ago. And I remember rushing to my television and being so shocked at the devastation that happened and just sitting in front of the TV watching CNN to see if there might be someone that we recognized or just any of the locations. Our family was frantically calling any of our family members who lived on the island and who currently still do to see if they were all right. And one thing that really stuck out to me was this woman who was screaming and shouting in the street. She had her hands to her head and she was yelling, "Nous pas gain secou," which means we don't have any hope. And when I saw that, it really broke me. So Maritza, where were you when you first heard about the earthquake?
I was a first year student at the University of Florida. I had just arrived not even a week in Paris, France, because I was studying abroad there, when I went to sleep and woke up the next day and had a ton of emails from the director of my study abroad program, classmates and friends, just checking in and making sure that I was okay. Our program was very small. There were like 10 of us, and it was just me and another Haitian student. And when I first read the email, it said something like, "Just let us know if you need time, if everything's okay at home, et cetera, et cetera." And I was very confused. I didn't have any cell phone or a television or anything. And I had checked my email before looking at news. So then I went back and I saw what was happening and I completely freaked out. I called home and was checking in on all of my family and making sure that everything was okay. It was really scary being thousands of miles away when I knew that people back home were hurting.
And as the day progressed and the death toll got higher and higher, it was really heartbreaking. When I finally got a hold of my family and learned that we did have some relatives that I hadn't even ever gotten to meet who passed away in the earthquake, it was very sad because there's that moment where you know you'll never be able to meet someone who's a part of you. But something that has stayed with me throughout all of this has been the response of the community, especially the Haitian community, the diaspora, the international community. Everyone was able to rally together and move so quickly to support my people.
And it's really my hope and our hope that one day Haiti will be able to achieve the heights that we know it is so capable of reaching, especially since it is the first Black republic to fight for and gain its independence. And we truly subscribe to the motto that is etched on Haiti's coat of arms, which is L'Union fait la force, which means
unity makes strength.
Thank you.
That was Maika and Maritza Molit, authors of the book Dear Haiti, Love Elaine. Well, still to come, what was the U.S. and international response to the Haiti earthquake? It's coming up next. Alleluia. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Again, 10 years ago, Haiti was shaken to its core, a massive earthquake, killing tens of thousands, destroying communities. Many Haitian Americans remember that day well and still live with the pain, like Worley Nortrius, who emailed us, and I'm paraphrasing his story here for time. "I was born and raised in Haiti. I was only 17 years old when the earthquake hit. It was after 4 p.m. I was in my room with my little brother and my other family members getting ready to go out. And out of nowhere, we heard a big boom. Then the house started shaking from left to right before it collapsed. After the earthquake, I saw bodies in the streets. Buildings were down. There was darkness because there was no electricity. My family and I became homeless. We spent months sleeping in the streets with strangers. My family and I moved to the Dominican Republic eventually to escape the pain and misery, and from there, we came to the U.S. to seek a better life. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial and share part of your story with us, just like he did. Again, I'm joined in studio by WLRN reporter Nadezh Green, WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett, and also joining us via Skype from Haiti is Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. Also joining me here in studio, Dr. Marie Gerda Nicolas, University of Miami psychologist, to share a little bit of her experience with the Haiti earthquake. And I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to ask you, 10 years later, how do people still deal with, what have you heard stories from people about the trauma? Is it still there? Does it still impact people's lives a decade later?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you've probably felt that when you heard the story by Jean-Samson Edouard, who's a member of our team in the Akaya region. There are things that happen in your life that are never forgotten, that becomes a central part of you. And I don't believe it's only related to the 10th anniversary. Sort of every January, every 12th of the month comes for you that you begin to think about the overall impact that it had. In addition to that, I think oftentimes when we think about disasters and we think about trauma, we think about post-traumatic stress, right? But in this situation, there's no post, right? We're talking about a constant trauma, because I can go around in Haiti right now and still see buildings that still have the crack on them. So those are a constant reminder of these particular experiences.
Anniversaries can actually be a bad thing because they're going to just churn up memories.
Well, you know, from a psychological perspective, we actually think it's a good thing, right? Because the number one issue that we oftentimes see that keeps traumas, that keeps symptoms at a chronic level is when you avoid them. Right. So having an anniversary allows you the opportunity to remember that something grave did happen. And it's an opportunity for us to continue the healing process as opposed to avoiding the situation.
Jacqueline, how are people on the ground there in Haiti? How are they talking about and thinking about this 10-year anniversary?
You know, it's really weird because, you know, what's going to happen the day after the anniversary is we're going to enter into another sort of uncertain political period. So a lot of people are kind of more fixated on the 13th. But, you know, when I was working on my project and I was talking to people about how they are going to approach this day, what I found from folks is that they weren't thinking so much about the 13th as is the daily struggle. I mean, things have not improved for a lot of people since the earthquake. And so I think that people are going to wake up on the 12th to that reality that, oh, my God, it's the 12th and it's been 10 years. But people have been more sort of focused on the political situation of the country and the uncertainty that they've been living in up to this moment.
You know, coming back, Dr. Nicolas, the other thing, too, is, we talk about mental health issues all the time mm-hmm. here in the United States and what we're dealing with just as Americans. But is there a structure in place in Haiti right now to help people with mental health issues, whether it's from the quake or not? But mm-hmm. is there a good a system in place?
But I would not say that there's a systematic, countrywide system in place. I want to say one thing related to what Jacqueline just said also. When we talk about the earthquake, we also oftentimes focus on Port-au-Prince, and we don't think about what's happening outside of Port-au-Prince. So if we remember, the epicenter of the earthquake was Léogâne and not necessarily Port-au-Prince, even though all the activities, and when we think about the earthquake, we think about Port-au-Prince. So I think it's good to think about what are some of the other things that are happening in other parts of the country. My experiences in Léogâne and places like Tigouave, that's next to Léogâne, people are, in fact, yes, it's true, political instability is at the forefront. But in addition to that, I do think people outside of the country on an annual basis have various kinds of ceremony and events to remember that particular day. And I would urge all of us not to necessarily focus our attention solely on what's happening in Port-au-Prince, but really think about what's happening outside of the country as well. But to go back to the question that you asked, I want to say that after the earthquake, one of the things we recognize is There was a report that was done in the New York Times where it indicated that there were 5 psychologists in the country. And as a result of that, an influx of people started coming into the country to provide psychological first aid in the country. Well, it turns out at that particular time, I had been working in Haiti for 20 years. This year is my 30 years, going to Haiti on a monthly basis, focusing on mental health in the country. So I know the number of 5 was not accurate, but it was clear that because we did not have a structure in place that allows people to be able to go on the net and see where are the Haitian psychologists, it led people to believe that, in fact, we didn't have one. And as a result of that, it forced us to create the Haitian Psychological Association, which is now in place in country, that includes both psychologists, Haitian psychiatric nurses, social workers, Haitian psychiatrists in the country. It has about a little bit over 160 members. Of the association. It hosts annual conferences focusing on Haitian mental health. And as a result of that work with them and Rebati, we've been able to also work with the Ministry of Health to integrate mental health as a part of the health plan. So at this particular moment in the last 5 years, we have Dr. René Domersan, who's a member of the cabinet, the Ministry of Health cabinet, for the very first time that allow us to make sure that mental health is being put as a forefront.
Something good comes out of all of this,
though. Absolutely.
You know, Tim, coming back to what Jacqueline said a moment ago is, you know, where the attention is, because there are a lot of political issues right now going on in Haiti. It comes back to what you said a little while ago, what it was like before the earthquake. Remind us a little bit about what it was like before the earthquake and everything that's happened since politically.
Well, what's happened since politically, unfortunately, is that even before the earthquake, and again, things were looking up in Haiti before the earthquake, but that doesn't negate the fact that the governing class of Haiti still had a lot of dysfunctional problems. It's easy to forget, as I say in my commentary today on WLRN.org, that 2 years before the earthquake, a couple of schools, shoddily constructed schools in Port-au-Prince, collapsed on children, and about 100 of them died. And that was a big result of just gross official neglect in Haiti. And it was a really bad reflection, as I said again, on the governing class of Haiti and its dysfunctions. Those dysfunctions, I think, and I don't know if Marie Gerda and Jacqueline and Dej would agree with me, but I think those dysfunctions have worsened since the earthquake. And we're seeing that manifested in the political chaos that Jackie is talking about. There is just the civics in Haiti right now are in a shambles, if not paralysis. And it just has to do with the fact that dysfunction of Haitian governance has not been addressed really since the earthquake. And that's made it doubly hard for the country to recover from the earthquake.
And I think the frightening thing is if another quake hit, you know, there is no, I mean, because usually after a disaster hits, we usually look at the standards of which how we build our cities and try to strengthen them. If a quake hit again at this point.
Well, again, we're talking about psychology. Psychologically, think of how Haitians feel right now when they know that the biggest political issue right now is a $2 billion embezzlement scam that's rocking the country. And those $2 billion were supposed to go to post-quake infrastructure projects. And if you know that money has been embezzled, that doesn't give you a lot of confidence in how the infrastructure is being rebuilt in Haiti.
Again, we're talking about the 10-year anniversary of the earthquake that hit Haiti. I've got a panel of reporters and experts here talking about how people in Haiti have been handling it since the quake. 10 years later, what are they thinking and feeling? And again, you could share with us your story. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundown. Nadege, did your family go back to Haiti, you know, shortly after? You didn't, but anybody go back?
No, you wouldn't go back, right, mm-hmm. to Port-au-Prince. There was nothing to go back to. My mom had a home in Port-au-Prince that was destroyed, in Bolipo neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. Like, there was nothing to go to, right? So unless you were a first responder or if you were someone actually helping, I think, at that time, it would have actually been, like, you would have been in the way mm-hmm. because there was nothing, like, you would be taking up necessary resources for the people who need it there.
You have a story that's coming out tomorrow. I want to play a little piece of it to let people know. This is a clip. This is of your aunt, and she was in search of her stepdaughter, who was at the University of Port-au-Prince, which had collapsed because of the earthquake. Let's take a quick listen.
When she got to the university,
It was as if there was an explosion. All she saw were plumes of white dust and mountains of broken concrete. And other parents, like her, calling out for their children. There was no heavy machinery to help move the rubble yet. The people who had gathered were digging with just their hands and maybe a shovel. She says she spent days out there looking for a sign of life or Michelangelo's body to take home.
Oh, tout journée, oui. Oh, tout journée, fait comme été. Wap chercher, oui. Mais toutes les formes femmes pas joindre.
It's a very personal story for you.
Yeah, when I was at the Herald, I ended up doing a series of first-person narratives around what it was like looking for loved ones after the earthquake. And I think one of the things that, you know, growing up Haitian is a very mystical community, regardless of your religious leanings, you'd be Catholic, Protestant, Vaudouisan, we're very mystical people. And like all communities, right, like how you honor your dead is such an integral part of who you are. And after the Haiti earthquake, one of the things we found, and like the piece that's airing tomorrow, is about grief and what it means to not have a body to grieve. Because my cousin, Michel-Ange Deis, who was at the University of Port-au-Prince, her class was to start at 5 p.m. That day, and the earthquake struck at 4:53, and the entire university collapsed. So she didn't make it out alive, and neither did hundreds of students. Tens of thousands of Haitians were never identified, right? They were never reunited with their families in death. The Haitian government had these mass grave sites to bury folks, but you don't know where your loved one is buried. And so like all of our rituals, you know, whether it's, you know, the teas that we drink, the ceremonies that we have before a funeral, those things did not happen. And that weighed on families so much because we respect the dead very much in the Haitian community. You know, when we talk about like our dead, we talk about our ancestors, regardless of where you believe they end up, right? Whether you believe in heaven or some other side, you know, we honor our ancestors. We are always talking. I mean, you have the Day of the Dead. We have the Month of the Dead. All of the month of November, we celebrate our dead, right? So it's a community that very much thinks that how you shepherd your loved one, you know, to the other side, or how you shepherd your loved one after death matters just as much as a birth, right? And so not having the ability to do that, to carry out these rituals, whether, you know, there's a bath that, you know, families will give the corpse, you know, or will direct the funeral home to give the corpse with very specific leaves. And, you know, every family, and depending on what part of Haiti you're from, you may have different rituals. Like in our part of Haiti, in Guaman, like you wash your hands with sour orange leaves after the funeral. Mm-hmm. So, but like all of those little things matter. And they're also helpful for the healing process, right? Like how you grieve. And so not having those things for closure meant that a lot of families just didn't get any closure. You know your loved one is no longer here, but you don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. Like in the case of my cousin, Michel-Ange, we don't know where the tractor or the dump trucks that ended up picking up her remains dropped her off.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. By the way, and that story is coming, you know, that story is coming up tomorrow on Morning Edition and ATC. Again, looking at the 10-year anniversary of the Haiti earthquake on today's program, collecting a lot of amazing stories. And we're going to continue. We're going to look at, coming up, still to come, we're going to look at the future. What is in store for Haiti? Again, they're facing a lot of political challenges, but the rebuilding, how is it going to continue? And when will they be able to get through all of this? We're going to talk about that and more coming up here on Sundial, coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A lot of money was put into helping rebuild Haiti. There was a lot of money that was supposed to be put into rebuilding Haiti. What happened to it? A decade later, we're still looking at the rebuilding of this nation after that earthquake back in 2010. We've been hearing a lot of stories from a lot of folks. And here's another one. This one from Fabienne Josephat, author of Dancing in the Barren Shadow. She shared this with us. I was running errands in Miami when the earthquake struck in Haiti, when I received a phone call from my mother to inform me. I didn't realize how serious the damage was until I looked around me and realized All the Haitian folks were on their phone. All of them were receiving the news at the same time, and they were terrified. My mother lived in Miami, my father was in Port-au-Prince, and he was stuck under rubble for hours. I didn't know his whereabouts for 48 hours. He made it out alive, but traumatized until his last breathing day. On the anniversary, I think of him and all those traumatized, still expecting another disaster to strike. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm joined in studio by WLRN reporters Nadege Green, WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett, via Skype, Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles, and in studio Dr. Marie Gerda Nicolas, University of Miami psychologist. Dr. Nicolas, I hear this, by the way, I hear that part of the story, still expecting another strike. That's part of the trauma, that you're expecting this could happen again, which, by the way, right now, Puerto Rico is experiencing earthquakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as you were talking before, earlier on, and I was thinking it's not an issue about if something will happen, it's when it's going to happen, I think, for us. And I think we have to have that language and that mentality, not only in Haiti, but also throughout the whole Caribbean. Clearly, we send our thoughts and our prayers to people in Puerto Rico, because we certainly know what that feels like all around. One of the things I wanted to mention as you were speaking, Luis, is that, you know, there are some positive things. There are opportunity for amazing things to come out of these terrible tragedies, you know, that happens. And one of the things that I think I'm very, very proud of right about this moment is the fact that as you look at as the Haitian community here in Miami is looking to remember this day and the significance of this day, we have over 20 Haitian organizations that come together to create a remembrance event called One Nation, One Voice, that's happening this Sunday. We as Haitian Americans, as Nadege was saying, have a role to play in coming together and ensuring that there is an opportunity to think about this day in a way that is meaningful for us, and also to think about the type of development that is needed in our home country as well. And so I hope everybody will join. I don't know if I get a chance to say it, but I hope everybody will join us this Sunday at 3:45 at the statue at the Toussaint statue for us, because that would be an opportunity
on 62nd Street and North Miami Avenue.
Exactly.
And we'll make sure together. Make sure to put that up on social media.
Because it is an example. For me, it is an example of Haitians coming together for Haiti in a very meaningful and a significant way.
Looking at the future, there are a couple things I want to point to just quickly are the groups that came in afterwards, the U.S. support, international support. Jacqueline, I want to start with you. One of the groups that came in was the Clinton Foundation. This is among the nonprofits that tried to take a leadership role in the recovery efforts. And there was a lot of criticism for their use of the funds. But just tell me a little bit about what President Clinton and what the Clinton Foundation was doing at the time in their assistance.
Well, we have to remember President Clinton was involved with Haiti before the earthquake. He was the UN Special Envoy to Haiti. And part of the reason why Haitians were looking up and Haiti was looking up is because he had held an investment conference in Haiti and got a lot of investors into Haiti and to look at those opportunities. So that was also feeding into the positive vibe, because right before then, Haiti had been hit by 4 hurricanes in less than 30 days and couldn't even get $1 billion from donors. So you have this earthquake, President Clinton is UN Special Envoy to Haiti, and then he goes into this role as co-chair of the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, which was supposed to be a way to get all of this aid, $13.3 billion that would eventually be, that was pledged, and to stay on donors and to ensure that they honor their commitment and to make sure that their commitment was in line with the Haitian government's priorities and its economic plans. Well, that hasn't necessarily happened. I mean, I met with President Clinton for my project. We talked about that. And what he was very clear, the stuff that he controlled, which was the Clinton Foundation money, that's for public record, and that money has been well spent. They didn't even take any administrative fees. And when you look around and you see some of those projects, you see, for instance, the Marriott Hotel, you see Caribbean Crafts, you know, people say, well, a hotel in Crafts. Well, Clinton, President Clinton always was pushing tourism, you know, prior to that. They eventually pulled out of Haiti and turned over a lot of what they were doing to Sean Penn's organization. But the big controversy has been about the IHRC, the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, and what happened to that money. It never handled any money. What I found through my reporting is that donors, including the U.S. government, held on to their money. They did not want to pool their money. So, for instance, 9 months after the earthquake, there was still enough rubble in this place to fit five football stadiums.
Yeah.
Why? The donors didn't want to pay for it.
Tim, Tim, elaborate more on that, but also it's just the fact that, again, you had U.S. international support, all these different groups. Who was in charge of handling the money? Who was in charge of handling?
Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of anyone in charge because, as we may have mentioned earlier, the Haitian government itself was paralyzed after this event, and the international community had to come in and fill a vacuum. That vacuum was also filled by just scores and scores of international NGOs. And I think the one big lesson, there are actually two big lessons that I think the international NGO community learned after this event was, one, you can't just block out the local population in the recovery effort. NGOs came in, they thought they had this salvation, the savior complex, they were going to save Haiti, and they essentially shut out too many Haitians in that process, which then in the long run makes it harder for the country to recover because you don't have the local population sort of trained and accustomed to what needs to be done. The other big lesson I think the NGOs learned was, and this was the headline of my story for Time Magazine a year after the earthquake, is it's the rubble, stupid. Because as Jackie just pointed out, it took a year for the international community to even start getting rubble removed. And you can't recover from an earthquake until the rubble's removed. The problem is NGOs don't look at rubble removal as something that's sexy. What they want on their brochures is a kid, you know, with a prosthetic leg being put on that tugs heartstrings. Removing rebar and concrete isn't sexy for an NGO. And that's a mindset that's got
to
change.
And to Tim's point on, you know, blocking out Haitians, I mean, ProPublica did a really powerful investigation on the Red Cross in 2015 that looked at how the Red Cross collected close to $500 million in Haiti and only built six homes. And one of, you know, in their reporting, they noted how, you know, some of the issues was there weren't even Creole speakers who were going out there doing this work. So how can you be in Haiti and you don't have anyone who speaks Creole? Or of the Haitian staff that was part of this, they were disparaged. They reported, you know, that they would talk down to them or to tell them to ignore Haitian CVs. And so this idea that you can come into a country and not actually bring in the people of that country. I mean, Haiti has architects, you have engineers, you have builders, you have people in Haiti, doctors, you know, but in the case of Red Cross, since we were talking about building, right? You actually have the people in Haiti who can do this. And, you know, like I think that Red Cross investigation was like a really clear, like, through line of just how NGOs can get it wrong. I mean, down to even confidential memos from the Red Cross. It was really a powerful investigation.
Looking ahead, Jacqueline, I come to you. I think about something I heard the Malit sister say earlier in the program, which is this hope for, you know, Haiti coming back to becoming great. How do Haitians in Haiti feel about their future, and what does that mean, reaching that greatness?
I mean, I think right now, you know, Haitians are not feeling good about their future, but at the same time, something else is happening here. I remember a year ago walking around here, and the level of apathy was so thick you could cut it with a knife. And it was because for Haitians, their future was outside of Haiti. We had this huge migration with Chile. And that's one of the things that happened after the quake. You had Haitians leaving, you know, going to Brazil, going to Chile, going to Mexico. We have Haitians in places where they did not exist before. And then that Chile spigot closed. And so Haitians had to, they were trapped. And so now you're seeing with these younger Haitians and these different petrol challengers, this anti-corruption, there's sort of an awakening that's happening. And I guess the best way to describe it is there's a fight going on for Haitians for their future. They don't see it yet. They don't see it clearly, but they're fighting for it.
And what, and Nadege, what role does the diaspora play in that?
I mean, I feel like the Haitian diaspora has always wanted to be a part of Haiti and will always want to be a part of Haiti. It will be a matter of whether or not they are received. And there is, you know, as Jackie points out, there is sometimes diaspora fatigue, and folks do check out sometimes. So it's a balance.
So I would disagree with my two colleagues. I love them dearly, but I disagree with that. I do think that Haitians in the diaspora, while there is tiredness, but I do think there's a level of engagement that is happening. You can tell that by the sheer number of people who continues to travel to the country and to play a key role. I think the young people in the country right now are excited about it, and they want to play a role in what's happening with them coming up. I can tell you about some amazing things that are happening in the country that is about the development of the country. So I do think that there's a level of hope and optimism that is happening right now.
I'm going to end it on that. A level of hope and optimism. Dr. Marie Guerda-Nicolas, University of Miami psychologist, also heard from WLRN reporter Nadege Green, Tim Padgett, our America's correspondent. We also had Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. Thank you so much, everybody.
You so much for having us.
And that is our program. We have a lot of great stories came in, and you can keep sharing your stories. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WLRNSundial. That's our program for this Thursday, January 9th. Coming up next week on Sundial, our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. She's in charge of the Florida Legislature statewide census count. We'll learn about the steps that Florida's taking to get an accurate census count, which starts this year. Plus, the play's American Son recently debuted on Broadway and was turned into a Netflix film. It takes place in a Miami police station as an interracial couple awaits news of their missing teenage son. It's playing now at the Arts Center. We'll learn more about it. And don't forget this month's Sundial Book Club. We are reading the book Mothers of Sparta. That's from Don Davies. Find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.